Welcome back to CMU Booked, Carnegie Mellon's official book podcast. I'm Sam.
And I'm Hannah. We are back. It feels so good to, you know, be in these seats again and to sit across from you, my dear.
My dearest Hannah, I'm so happy to be back here with you. Let's get started.
How are classes? How is the beginning of the year?
It's actually insane. This is so funny. Last class I had was writing for the professions, and I was sitting in there and I got an email that was, sign up for your time slot to get senior photos. And I was like, what happened?
Oh my God, Sam, the same thing just happened to me, except my parents forwarded it to me, which is somehow worse. Freaking out in the apartment, yep. You know. No, but I'm happy, guys. I love being a senior. And we're 2 weeks in.
Yep.
Have you been like, any standout things you've watched, read, you know, our cultural consumption?
Ooh, as of super recently, I watched The Devil Wears Prada for the first time in my life 3 weeks ago, not even a week ago. Life changing. I also then watched Easy A, and I was like, Stanley Tucci, I need you in my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's everything.
He's kind of everything I need and more.
Have you seen the SNL bit, Tucci Gang?
Please tell me more.
Sam Rockwell pretends to be Stanley Tucci and Pete Davidson raps like Gucci Gang, Gucci Gang, except it's Tucci Gang, Tucci Gang, Tucci Gang. Listen to it. Drop a comment, your thoughts. Yeah. So Devil Wears Prada. Anything for class?
Ooh, for class? You know, I'm reading this. I would love to. I'm going to have our producer Google who wrote it, but The Fruit of My Woman by Han King, I want to say. Anyways, great short story I read for Transnational Feminisms, which is a really cool class. Shout out if you're listening from this class. I'm excited for our discussion next week because there's been some really cool readings. Mm-hmm. And this is actually like my first gender studies or feminism sort of class that I've taken. So I've been really enjoying it. And I love the professor.
Taken a bunch of classes, reading quite a bit. I've read Brokeback Mountain recently, ooh, short story. Annie Proulx, I think it's from 1996, not super sure. Amazing. Watch the movie. It's for an adaptation class. Right now I'm about to read The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which I've never read, but my mom tells me she really likes. So I'm excited for it. What have you read this summer?
Give me that.
Shout out. I think you should leave.
We'll get into it later. Read The Shining for the first time and had an opinion on it. Loved the book. And here's the thing. I hadn't seen the movie ever in my life. Did not know what happened. And so I watched the movie directly after. And this is like, for the viewers, I went to Hannah and I was like, that's the worst movie I've ever seen. And she lost her mind.
I don't understand.
She hates me. Well, she hates me.
I can never hate you. But I do like, I like the book. I like the movie better.
Yeah.
And I'm the worst. Never. I'm the worst. I like Stanley Kubrick. I read a lot this summer, actually. I read The Magpie Murders. That was okay. I read The Tokyo Zodiac Murders. I read a lot of crime books because I just wanted to. I read Rebecca. I also read Pachinko, which we both dabbled in.
She was thick.
She was a thick book.
Yeah. Actually incredible, though.
Absolutely life-changing.
Did it make you cry? Be honest.
Yes.
Of course it made us
cry. It made me cry many times.
Yeah.
So we also both read Ninth House, which I absolutely loved. I also loved the sequel, Hellbent, and now I am itching for the third because I need certain things to happen for me to be...
It was the type of thing where I was like reading it at work, like when people weren't looking at me.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a great time getting through it, like kind of in little increments. Felt like I wanted to be resistant towards the idea because I don't read a ton of fantasy, but actually reading it, like I found myself being very invested. And like every time I would put it down, I need to pick it back up. So I think that says a lot.
Yeah.
And I need to read the second book. Do you have it?
I do have it. I'm gonna borrow it. It's she definitely pushes you into the fantasy world, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
And speaking of fantasy and sci-fi fantasy.
So I read this little indie book, not a lot of people know about it. It's called Dune. So I read Dune for the first time for this podcast. Actually, I was just kind of reading it, and then we were like, let's actually do this because I love this book and I was super excited about it. Also watched the movies with Hannah for the first time, and I was obsessed with the adaptation, I would say. Tell me what you think about the adaptation.
Well, I love it. Well, I absolutely love it. I think, and this is a good thing to say because it's important for, I think it's important for people to know that this is the best sci-fi and fantasy series that exists. I think it's better than Star Wars. I think it's better than Star Trek. I think it's better than basically every sci-fi movie that's come out. And I'll stand on that. I'll die on that hill. No book and then to movie adaptation has ever rocked me this much.
The author, Frank Herbert, you know, I was impressed. Color me impressed.
And this book, I'm checking what year it was actually published.
I believe the 60s.
It's in the 60s. So 1965.
Right.
The idea that this book exists and was all about truly, I mean, like, it's about intergalactic political diplomacy. It's such a like staunch and astute study of diplomacy generally and the ways in which, I don't know, I just think it's, I think it's really amazing that it was so ahead of its time.
Right.
And the fact that they've redone it, from the 80s, or maybe it was in the 90s remake, David Lynch directed it, although he didn't really direct it. He didn't like it. He doesn't want people to know that he directed the movie. Fun little tidbit. But, I mean, in a very basic way, that film adaptation had no people of color. It's a desert planet. Arrakis is a desert planet.
There's some white people in there, like, we'll be good.
All pale. It makes no sense.
Right.
It makes no sense. But I'm so, like, I was so, so geeked to hear that Sam was reading this book. And yes, you haven't seen the David Lynch adaptation.
No, I haven't. You know what? Steve Macon, shout out Steve Macon, was showing me clips of it in the GLAAD.
Why?
But he was like, no, the CGI is so bad. And I was watching, I was like, I don't know, it kind of looks fine to me. But maybe I'm not a harsh enough critic.
Well, that's not the problem with the movie. The problem with the movie is that it does the book so dirty, it's ridiculous.
Right.
Also, like, right, the movies don't even cover, the two movies that are out right now don't even cover the entirety of this narrative.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't. So the idea that they could squish, like, the David Lynch's, squishes everything in.
Mm-hmm.
There's no time.
Yeah.
There's no time to cover it. This is a thick book. And yeah, the bibliography for all of the words and, you know, names of things, it's just very extensive. It's, you know, it takes effort to read this book.
Yeah. And I think that's a good exercise for me because I tend to read a lot of, like, mom books. Shout out Kristen Hannah. You know, when I'm having a long day, it's like, I just want to read The Nightingale, The Great Alone. And it's like, I can follow that really easily. This, in being hard to follow, makes you kind of a reader that you have to be dedicated to the story. And I think it's impressive.
And I think that the structure is also really enticing. Every single chapter starts off with an entry from Princess Irulan's diary, who is, you know, the sort of galactic emperor's daughter, who, spoiler alert, by the end of the book, marries Paul. Sorry about that.
Wait, none I was of us, gagged.
Yeah, none of us actually wanted that to happen, I think, especially because, like, Chani is his concubine, like his own, or what would it be? The consort?
Yeah.
Consort.
He's acting in the same fashion that his dad did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I should have married you. What a line.
The people who can destroy a thing, they control it.
Yes.
You know, I thought that was really compelling. And also, I know you love the quotes that the movies start with. I don't know if you could recite them.
Okay. First movie, dreams are messages from the deep. Second movie, power over spice is power over all. Two gags. I was gagged.
Yeah.
Actually, I think everyone was gagged. I think we all were gagged.
I think we all sing.
I don't know. I think the politics are so central to this novel, which I think is what initially enticed me. I think that the idea of a holy war, a charismatic leader, and whether or not things are, you know, fated, or if it's people creating that fate, which leads to things like war and violence and, you know, I think it speaks volumes towards the beginning of the book when Paul, when he inhales the spice in the tent and starts having visions of a holy war, you know, a banner in my father's name. He is horrified by this. But by the end, when he's sort of changed, he's drunk the water of life, he survived it. And so you also have this thing of like, is he the chosen one?
Yeah.
Kind of looks like he's the chosen one. But on the other hand, you're a fanatic promoting a holy war in which people will blindly follow you based on a fate written by those in power, like the Bene Gesserit. What were your thoughts on the test at the beginning of the book and, I guess, the first movie and the Bene Gesserit generally?
Ooh, so one of the first things that I said to you when you were like, we're going to watch the movie, I asked you, do they have the scene with the box, with the hand box? Because I was so captivated by that scene and the way that it's written.
Can I say something into the mic?
Yes.
It is the best first chapter of any novel ever.
Let's talk about it.
Agreed.
Agreed. So, no, I was obsessed with the way that it starts off so quickly with that. And I love the way that it was adapted. It was almost exactly what I saw in my head. And that's always like a treat for me. But the Bene Gesserit, and I this is a weird reference, but it reminded me of like Handmaid's Tale, you know, this like group of women that are being treated differently by society, whether it be in positions of power or in positions of very, very little power. Mm-hmm. And I was really taken by Lady Jessica.
She is the goat.
Yeah, she's the goat. So I was also wondering, like, is this book is written in the 60s, is this radical feminism to have Lady Jessica in this really strong position of power throughout a lot of the novels? You know, she's soft in her femininity in a lot of it, but also she's, you know, pushing a lot of that action.
I mean, her and the Bene Gesserit's witchcraft and spiritual power, you know, ascends spiritual power. It's also political power, which they're able to mitigate. You know, they're crossing bloodlines over centuries. And I think Frank Herbert, and maybe people have written about this, I would actually love to research it, whether or not, you know, it was from a feminist perspective, just because the Bene Gesserit are so important, and honestly, the most important, I think, above all others, the Menats, the Harkonnens, the Sadukars, all of them. I think that the fact that when she gets mad at the mother superior of the Bene Gesserit, when she gets mad at Jessica for having a son, and she's like, you were told to only bear women. It's like, wow, women are just like in charge of things, even supernaturally, which I enjoyed as just like a little tidbit. Yeah. But yeah, I think that they're the most important. They're swaying the politics. They're the reasons why the Harkonnens, you know, she convinces the emperor to have the Harkonnens leave Arrakis to give it to the Atreides. They're getting too much power. So I think it's very central. And specifically with the scene with the Gom Jabbar, what did you make of sort of this line that I wanted to sort of touch on, where it says, the old woman said, you've heard of animals chewing off a leg to escape a trap? There's an animal kind of trick. A human would remain in the trap, endure the pain, feigning death that he might kill the trapper and remove a threat to his kind. And then she says, I'm doing this to determine if you're human. Be silent.
I think that if he is the first man to be taking this test, or boy to be taking this test, it says something really interesting about what they assume about instincts of women, and that they assume that women will do anything it takes to survive. And I think that that's an interesting, you know, aspect. If they're testing a man on this for the first time, then what does that say about Paul specifically as a man, and what the Bene Gesserit expect of men?
I mean, their prophecy foretold of the Kwisatz Haderach being able to drink the water of life, which only women have done, to be, you know, the head mother of the Fremen. So I'm not exactly sure about the box, or the Gamjabar, but I definitely thought that, I think in the movie she says, like, an animal in a trap will gnaw off its leg to be free. What will you do? And, you know, he endures the pain and it, you know, sort of becomes him. And I think that, again, that's the interesting question that the book poses. Is he truly the chosen one? Or is this all sort of a spider web of fate being brought together by manipulative people in power?
There's so much culture and world building that goes into this book that is really, like, representative of kind of religion and, like, you know, political structures in our world. And to me, I'm like, you know, what is real? Is being the president real? Is this real? Like, I don't know. The chosen one is something that their societal construct has made to be a thing. And if you pass XYZ test, then you become that. So I guess in my opinion, for the purposes of their structure, like, yeah, he's the chosen one.
I want him to be.
Yeah. I don't know.
For supernatural's sake, I want it to be, because this is a sci-fi fantasy novel. And I think that that makes it more rounded. And I also think that it really complicates the rest of what the novel is saying about, you know, the jihad and the holy war and fanaticism. Like, I think that that really complicates it when there is a sliver of truth, but there's still so much doubt and opposing opinions. I think that it's really, oh, guys, can you tell that I geek over this book? I think it's really amazing. I think the world building is second to essentially, like, Lord of the Rings, honestly. I've never had so many words, terms, places to memorize and understand. Like, their Bibles. The terminology is just like, and the species are all just so different. So shout out Middle Earth.
We talk about Aaliyah, who I was kind of obsessed with, and immediately had to ask you before we watched the movie, like, where is she?
Yeah. And she is in literally 1 second. She just says, "Paul." And it's and it's Anya Taylor-Joy.
Hey, girl.
Which also the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
It's the best thing in the world.
Well, yes.
Can I just tell you, the fact that I saw her at the premiere, that they let that not be a surprise. I'm sorry. And pardon my French. Fuck that. Literally, whatever happened to surprises? First of all, I don't want the trailer to show me anything. I won't watch trailers. I'll put my head down in the movie theater, cover my eyes and my ears like a total psychopath. But that pissed me off. I'm sorry. Like, let it be a surprise. I didn't know how much was going to be in this movie, you know? And obviously there's going to be another where they got to actually put the Aaliyah stuff in anyway. But I mean, that ancestral knowledge from birth, yo.
Well,
he says things when he dreams and has visions, they represent something. They don't play out. You know, he says to the head of the Bene Gesserit, like, not exactly. They don't happen the same exact way. And I think that that probably extends to, right, like when Jessica drinks the water of life and has the burden of all of the elder women before her, I think it's probably a representative state. But Aaliyah, man, I do not know. I do not know what is, like,
yeah,
what's in her brain. Like, they talk about it, but it's still sort of like, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Totally.
But yeah, I mean, I'm so excited for the third movie just because she needs to be in it.
I love her.
Yeah.
And I'm also just wondering, like, because a lot of what Paul is dealing with is stuff that he's been taught by his parents who have very different perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, Duke Leto is, like, you know, more of your typical ruler. And then he also is trained in, like, the Bene Gesserit ways. So he has a unique perspective, which makes him, I think, such a strong ruler and exactly what the people need. But I guess that's what you were saying is exactly why I was questioning him as, like, a prophet, because how much of it can we actually trust, especially because it has to be interpreted by somebody who has, you know, specific stakes, like emotional stakes in this war.
I have conflicting opinions about him being a strong leader. I mean, yes, the Fremen are oppressed. Mm-hmm. They want someone to be their leader. But, I mean, there's something to be said that Paul is an outsider who has inserted himself for religious extremism and at the hands of the Bene Gesserit, I think. it's complicated with the mother superior of the Bene Gesserit at the end. I think that that definitely complicates things in the way that she's sort of, her and Jessica are at each other's throats. In this line of being a prophet, what do you make of the relation between the Harkonnen and the Atreides and Paul? What do you, how do you think that complicates your opinion of him as a charismatic and stable ruler?
He's almost neither of those. Is he stable? No. I'm going to go absolutely not. Is he a good ruler? He's there. That's a big thing about Paul, in my opinion, is that he's like sort of in this space. He's trying to fill the space of his dad, you know? His dad is killed, and he's taking a lot of what he was taught by him. And all he knows, he has this line in the movie where he says, I know everything about the Harkonnens. Like, when he's, you know, giving this big speech and coming into a place of power with the Fremen, he explains that he doesn't know the desert like them, like the Fremen do, but he knows everything there is to know about the Harkonnens, which I saw as a really smart move in order to, you know, show some humility and gain the respect of the Fremen. But I don't see it as necessarily true, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. No, I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said about Muad'Dib.
Muad'Dib
means little mouse. Mm-hmm. You know what little mice are? Sneaky. Mm-hmm. They're sneaky. I don't know. I feel like that's not entirely, like, that shouldn't be lost on us. Mm-hmm. And they give him that name because of his, you know, affinity for them. The quietness, the, you know, I think that it's intentional. But I also wonder, like, with the Harkonnens, the Baron, Feodrotha, what did you think about the segue, sort of, not segue, but their importance in the novel?
I really, really enjoyed reading the chapters that were from the more of the perspective of the Baron.
Yeah,
I really thought that that was interesting. And I like that we got both of the perspectives. And it was just kind of like interspersed, like not super often. You're usually with Paul, but I loved that we got both perspectives because it doesn't make you feel necessarily like justified in either of the in anybody's camp, you know. Everyone mm-hmm. is like, it's war at this point, you know. And I really enjoyed being able to understand, not perspectives, because they suck, you know, the Harkonnens suck,
yeah,
but I enjoyed being able to see what their next plan was, especially so that then when you get back into Paul's head in the chapter afterwards, you understand like how they're at in steps of like war and how they're getting in each other's heads.
Yeah. And just the gravity of the situation, how it's building the, you know, the tension and also just the closeness. I really enjoyed that in the second film, we got to hear it. Mm. Like she's recording it on this like futuristic little tape recorder as like a verbal diary, which like I just loved. And I guess this is a good segue to talk about performances. Right. Lizan Al-Ghaib. Our star.
Yes. Timothée Chalamet.
Timothée. Yeah, oh my God. Shout out Adam Sandler.
Bring him back to campus. We love Timothée Chalamet household.
Did you really like his performance? Be honest with me.
I'm going to like break her heart if you say no, guys. No, I loved his performance. And here's the thing. I loved his performance and I loved Zendaya's performance. I did not feel the chemistry like I did in the book. And I'm going to say that to you, and I don't want to, like, break your heart right now.
I was into it, but also, like, I can't give a straightforward answer, honestly, because I'm so, well, I think the book is more passionate, period.
Yeah.
I think the book is more passionate, period. And I also think that in the movie, Leto and Jessica got mad chemistry. And I think that they mirror the book very well.
Yeah.
Ugh, I should have married you. I just think that that's like the most heartbreaking line. Like, Leto just has the best lines. He truly is like an Eddard Stark of sorts for me. Shout out Game of Thrones season one. Mm-hmm. No spoilers.
Going to watch it.
Sam, you are not going to watch that show. I am putting money down that you won't watch that show.
I'm not
going to
watch it.
You don't like
guys.
Gore, right?
Not a big gore fan.
Yeah, you can't watch it. You literally, I won't let you watch it. You'll throw up.
I will. I will faint, guys.
But he also has a line where he's like, they tried to take the life of my son.
My boy.
So great.
Yeah.
Oscar Isaac is amazing.
I Okay, like to everyone who's seen Moon Knight, because I'm a Marvel girly. Like,
I have not seen.
One of his best performances in the entire world. Like, I genuinely believe that is so incredible what he does as an actor, because he's playing three different roles. It's like it's like a cognitive dissonance. Like, he has different. It's so good. I need to talk about the scene in the tent. You made me a freak, essentially, is what he's screaming at his mother. And I was so... Hannah and I had very different reactions, which I was like, dude, Paul's being an asshole. Like, stop. But Hannah's also completely right, and I'll let you defend your position.
Oh, yeah. I was just saying, like, yeah, you did. You've put this in huge weight on your child's shoulders to be the chosen one who you thought you could... you know, create, which, like, maybe she did.
yeah, so, give, like, my girl props.
No, she... hey, man, if someone was going to do it, Jessica was going to be the one. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Also, the idea that they're carefully crossing bloodlines and the fact that an Atreides father and a barren, like a Harkonnen woman turned Bene Gesserit isn't, like, the chosen one is crazy to me.
No, yeah.
But I thought he was sort of in the right. She did make him a freak. She put this huge burden on his shoulders, gave him these powers that no other man has or can live with. And yeah, so.
This is a quote from the book that I felt connected to the scene in the tent in the first movie. And it says she felt a sudden fear of her son and for him. And I highlighted that because I was like, this is, you know, she's scared for herself because she's her own person, but she's also scared for her son.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, you know, powerful.
Definitely. But you also had a child knowing that it was for alternative religious reasons.
That's
and
true.
Altered how it happened. Yeah. And I think that when Leto questions her and is like, will you, like, I'm not asking, you know.
Great scene.
His mother, I'm asking the Bene Gesserit. Are you going to stand by our son? And, like, she never has to answer that question.
Right.
She never asked you.
Right.
So I don't know. I really don't know. I think that Paul's got baggage, guys. Paul has baggage.
Sad boy.
Also, Dr. Yue, what a fuck. Like,
wait, I'm so mad.
I'm sorry. You thought the Baron was going to give your wife back to you? Yo, the Baron does not know who the hell your wife is, and he probably killed her with one, you know.
Poison dart.
Yeah, who cares? He doesn't care.
Yeah.
That guy is an idiot. I'm sorry. Like, I know that you got to keep hope alive, but dear Lord.
Wait, no, back to Rebecca Ferguson.
Yes.
Tell me what you thought of her performance.
I love it. I love it. I think that her, especially in the second film, I think she's amazing. I think Denis Villeneuve, the director, who is, like, honestly... probably one of my favorite directors. Like, I love Blade Runner 2049. He's Arrival. He's amazing.
We have
the scope.
Complicated feelings on Arrival.
Let's not even Sam, let's not. Oh my gosh. Now I'll cry. Their daughter's name is Hannah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's cute.
What song would you assign this book?
Don't know if anyone's gonna know it. Unfortunately, Savages by Marina. I love Marina. I'm seeing her in concert in a few weeks. But it's this song about, like, you know, who we are as people when everything else is stripped away. And I think that who we are underneath it all is sort of a takeaway that I had from the book that made me think of this song.
Dear Lord, I have to follow that. You are not going to like what I have to say.
I'm going to love it, I assure you.
The song that I would choose for this book is Illegal. By Pink Panthers.
Is it illegal?
It feels illegal. Totally feels illegal. Sorry.
Tell me a little bit.
My name is Pink and I'm really glad to meet you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You're recommended to me by some people. Okay. Hey. Is this illegal?
Dramatic reading.
Feels illegal. That's how I think this book goes. That's honestly my answer.
Wait, so in this world is... is Paul Pink Panthers? Or is Pink Panthers talking to Paul? Can I ask that question?
Pink Panther?
Pink Panthers. Oh my God, am I stupid? Pink Panthers.
Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
Is he singing this? Like, where does it come to play?
Dare I say Chani's singing it?
Well, of
this
course.
Is illegal. I mean, what he is doing is illegal. All right, guys. So, for our CMU question of the week. Oh, I'm so excited. I missed them.
I know.
What was your song of the summer?
I'm going to go ahead and easy answer say, my back shots sound like bongo.
Bum, bum, bum.
Did that even come out? It came out forever ago. Anyways.
We just were obsessed with singing it this summer.
It was my song of the summer.
Yeah.
And Hannah, what was yours?
Nokia by Drake.
Wait, sing it for me. I don't know if I know this.
Who's calling my phone? Who's calling that? Thank you guys so much for listening.
Remember to follow us on Instagram at CMU Booked. And please reach out if you want to be a guest, pitch us books, all that good stuff.
If you see us on campus, you know, the best way to get on this podcast is to just tackle me and start screaming, CMU Booked, CMU Booked.
Yeah, don't be awkward, guys. Yeah. All right. Bye, everyone.